This is the British Broadcasting Corporation. We present a further edition of British American Brains Trust, in which a distinguished panel of people from both sides of the Atlantic meet to give unrehearsed answers to questions sent in by listeners. Here now is David Lloyd James to introduce the discussion.
This is David Lloyd James introducing the British American Brains Trust, in which a panel of distinguished people here in the studios of the BBC in London answer questions put to them by Americans in Britain or sent direct by listeners in the United States. Let me introduce you to tonight's team straight away. First of all, we have Mrs. Mary Agnes Hamilton, who's done a great many things in her life. She's been a Labour Member of Parliament. She's an author who's travelled widely in the United States. And at the moment, she's doing a job intimately connected with Anglo-American relations. Next, we have Alan Mickey, the American in our team, who's lived over here for some time as the representative of various American magazines. He, too, is an author. Then we have Sir Stuart Wilson, until recently in charge of the music at the BBC, and now Deputy General Administrator of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. He himself knows the United States well. And last of all, there's Dr. Charles Hill, a Member of Parliament for Luton and Secretary of the British Medical Association. He is an extremely well-known broadcaster in Britain. Before his election to the House of Commons, he was the radio doctor who did a weekly health talk. And now, if everybody's ready, we'll start off with the first question. I'm going to ask it myself, and I hope it'll serve the dual purpose of introducing you all to our listeners, and also giving them a warning of what they can expect during this session. And here's the first question. Do you enjoy being rude when a really good opportunity presents itself and you feel that you're justified? Do you enjoy being rude? Mary Agnes Hamilton.
I confess quite frankly that I do. When the really good opportunity presents itself. In other words, when someone asks me a totally unjustified question or makes an observation that rouses lively resentment. I'm sorry afterwards, but I enjoy it at the time.
Dr. Hill.
Well, I'm surprised that a former Member of Parliament hasn't overcome that temptation to be rude and being asked a silly question. All I can say is, yes, I do. But latterly I've learnt that to be rude in the good old vigorous way is really less satisfying than being rude in a more cunning, courteous way. I've learnt that courteous understatement is the best vehicle for the most appalling rudeness.
Sir Chet Wilson.
I was told when I was young that a gentleman was one who was never rude except on purpose. There's something to be said for that, and I rather agree with Dr. Charles Hill that being rude with subtlety, this understatement, which is considered to be so much the English vehicle, sometimes of wit, very seldom of charm, but now apparently of rudeness. Really, what a nation we are. We can do everything by understatement. I agree. I don't really enjoy it. I think it has to be done. I don't enjoy crocking an insect, but it has to be done.
And now can we ask Alan Mickey?
Well, I think, like Mary Hamilton, that I must confess that I do enjoy being rude under certain conditions. Not necessarily in answer to silly questions, but particularly when, as the question says, a really good opportunity presents itself, or I feel that I am justified. I no longer, or at least in my younger days, perhaps might have enjoyed being rude purely for the opportunity to score a verbal point off my opponent. I think that with increasing years, I've gotten over that. But taken by and large, I must confess to the basic question, I do at times enjoy rudeness.
Well, I think I can sum up as far as the Brains Trust is concerned here by saying that all the members of the Brains Trust have acquired a real palate for being rude, though it's matured, I think, as time has gone by. So we'll pass on to the second question, which comes from Tom Farmer, a student at Harvard, who asks this. To what do you attribute the main frictions between Britain and America, and do you think they can ever be eradicated? To what do you attribute the main frictions between Britain and America, and do you think they can ever be eradicated? Alan Mickey?
As an American, I suppose I better take the first crack at that. This really requires a full report by itself in order to answer it properly. I would say, at the risk of being misunderstood by my fellow countrymen, perhaps, that one of the basic reasons, and I don't talk of reasons to be found in current events or present-day misunderstandings. One of the real basic reasons for friction between the two countries is what I should call, at the risk of being misunderstood, something of an inferiority complex on the part of Americans. Now, you could enlarge on that to the length at least of a book. But basically what I mean is that there is a feeling on the part of many Americans that there's a great deal to be envied, perhaps, in either the British way of life or the British character or something more physically connected with Britain. I think that is one of the fundamental reasons why there's a certain amount of jealousy or, as I say, inferiority as far as our approach to Britain is concerned.
Thank you, Alan Mickey. Now, let's have a British view about this from Dr. Charles Hill.
Well, I was just going to add a word in converse. I agree with what's been said. I believe that there is a feeling in America, one detects it when one's there, a feeling of mixed respect and inferiority for the history, the traditions, the background. Sometimes I think the serenity of this country. At the same time, I think there's another factor at work. It's said that the best way to lose a friend is to lend him or to give him a fiver. And I think that in this country, one element in Anglo-American relations is the fact that America has been so generous to us. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting it's ingratitude, but it's an almost essential element in that relationship that there's some tension, some friction, some feeling of financial inferiority, call it what you will. But the very generosity of itself creates a problem in international relations.
Mr. Stuart Wilson.
I would like to say, why do we want to eradicate friction? I was taught in the very little elementary physics that I ever learned that there was no progress possible without friction, just as much as there's no light without heat. You can't talk without raising an argument. You can't get along with people without having some friction between them. I should hate to eradicate friction. It means stagnation.
Thank you, Sir Stuart. Mary Agnes Hamilton, can we have your view?
Well, I agree very largely with the views so delightfully expressed by Stuart Wilson. And certainly I think that if friction means controversy, the capacity to have differences, to discuss them frankly, to have them out in the open, this probably will persist and is an element of infinite value in our relations. At the same time, I think neither country can escape from its history. And in a sense, it's part of the mythology of the United States that we were at one time the imperialist power which they threw out. It's part of our realization of the changed face of the world that we, who were one of the great powers of the world, are now not so great. But I don't think that the differences that the varied stages of our development import constitute frictions in the sense that frictions are dangerous, but they do constitute those loyal differences of opinion which enable people to learn. And nothing seems to me more exhilarating at the present than the movement into being of a North Atlantic community, conscious of its ties in a common culture with ourselves, with countries of the Commonwealth, and with the United States, which can proceed through the democratic process of not agreeing about everything.
Thank you. I'm not going to ask for second thoughts about that, because, if I may say so, the members of the Brains Trust have expressed themselves so particularly clearly, and also because this is the kind of topic of conversation which might well go on for the rest of the evening. I think we'd better pass on to the next one, which introduces, in a sense, rather a lighter note. Lewis Gallup, studying at the University of Cincinnati, puts this problem. I'm a fan of the crooners. My wife prefers Bach. As far as I'm concerned, that's fair enough. But I suspect that her preference has an element of snobbery in it, and that she would like Bach much less if he was as popular as Bing. This superiority puts me off Bach. Is my suspicion justified? Is his suspicion justified? Do you think I can call on Mrs. Stuart Wilson here?
I think it's fair, as I'm here as a musician, but I quite understand about snobbery. And I think there is a good deal of snobbery of those who prefer Bach to Bing, and a great deal of the inverted snobbery of those who say, well, I've done with those old classics, they're played out. Might I just tell him one story, which is quite irrelevant? One day when I was with a travelling opera company, I was sitting up in the gallery at a performance where I was not taking part of Tristan and Isolde. I heard a young man come out and say to the girl he was with, isn't that wonderful? Oh, isn't that glorious music? And the girl said, well, for my own part, I prefer something lighter. So I tapped him on the shoulder and said, don't marry her, and disappeared into the crowd.
Interfering old rock.
Dr. Hill, can we have your view?
Well, I'm the lowest of the brows here, I've no doubt, and I agree that his suspicion is more than justified. There are a large number of people in this world who rejoice in something that's enjoyed by the minority or something that's unpopular, just the delight of being precious, of being exceptional, and I've no doubt it's true in this case, as in many others.
Mary Agnes Hamilton.
Well, the only thing that I would like to put to both the question to Mr. Lewis Gallup and to his wife is, why must you be so horribly exclusive? It seems to me the joy of musical appreciation and of literary appreciation is the infinite variety through which one can range. And I dreadfully deplore the numerous friends of mine who, admiring Bach or Bing, won't admit anyone else and say you must be on one side or the other. The fun of music or of any aesthetic appreciation is that in one mood one has one, in one the other, and why not enjoy both?
Alan Mickey.
Well, I, like Dr. Hill, I can take my Bach or leave it alone. But at the same time, as an ex-dance band man myself, I have a large collection of swing music. I also have a large collection of classical music, which both my wife and I enjoy listening to.
Yeah, yeah.
I personally wouldn't say that that there's an essential element of snobbery in being appreciative of Bach as such. I see that the question says that if Bach were as popular as Bing, Crosby is today, then perhaps the snobbery element would disappear. I think my answer to that is that knowing the superior technician that Bach was, assuming that he were alive today and he had a press agent as good as Crosby's, I think he probably would be as popular.
The view of the Brains Trust is that there's a place for Bing and for Bach. It may not be the same place, but there's a place for both. Our next question comes from a public relations officer in Washington, D.C. He sent us in this query: if you were a congressman, an MP, or controlled a large enterprise doing some public service, what would your attitude be to public opinion surveys? Would you read them, act on them, or ignore them? Would you read them, act on them, or ignore them? Wilson?
Have we got to say that if we read them all, we've got to act on them all, or can't we read them and decide that no part of them is worth acting on? That is the common factor, I think, in most public opinion surveys, is you read it and decide that some part of it applies to you and some doesn't. You can't act on it all, and you can't possibly ignore it. If you're going to ignore it, you shouldn't read it.
Thank you. Dr. Hill.
Well, that's all very complicated. I'm assuming that the survey's on some subject in which one's interested or involved. Of course I should read it. If it confirmed the opinion I'd held before the survey was taken, I would act on it. I should ignore it.
That's a very fair answer. Would you like to comment on that?
There speaks, I think, the really practical congressman who has to act. Speaking now of someone more in the public relations field, I would say it depends a great deal on what the survey purports to survey. If it's a perfectly general survey of opinion, I should say you read it and probably ignore it. But if it concerns some quite specific point within your own ambit which you can check off upon, then I think you would read it. But as for acting on them without check, no, I think in no circumstance should one do that. Nor should one ignore them, because if they are circumscribed in their field, they may be very useful. They're apt to be much too general and vague.